I'm John Batchelor, speaking to the editor-in-chief of Civitas, the Civitas Outlook, which is the publication of Civitas Institute at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm speaking to the editor-in-chief, Richard Reinsch, who is writing up a new book, a collection of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's remarks, speeches, addresses, Nobel Prize address, after he was thrown out of the Soviet Union in 1974. Exiled is the polite way of putting it. And he retreated to Vermont, where he started to write about his experience in Russia and what Russia had gone through in the 20th century. It's important to recover that this is the Cold War. There was never a moment on television, in the movies, in books, in comic books, when the moment couldn't be called up that the world would end because of atomic weapons. Never a moment. Solzhenitsyn understands that, but at the same time, he's gripped by what he experienced in Russia when he wasn't free and what he viewed of America's way of dealing with freedom. The West is what he called us. Richard, I remember being puzzled about Solzhenitsyn's, what you'd have to say, unhappy opinion of the West. What was it? What did he find that was inadequate to his vision when he was in the gulag?
Yeah, and thank you. Great question. And I think this also has immediate resonance ongoing with our moment, because it's the inability, I think, of the West to properly come to terms with communism's end and what it means to have defeated communism that sort of prepares the way for a lot of things that have happened in the West the last 30 years, to see this as just a triumph of capitalism, as just a triumph of unlimited human freedom, of capital D democracy, of humanitarian progressive democracy, something like that, that it's all sort of tied into man's cleverness that defeated this evil of communism. And Solzhenitsyn says it's really not that. Communism moves forward by, he says, almost a spiritual heresy, a conquest of the human person in the name of perfection, in the name of bringing an end to misery through this grand ideological project. And the West, he thinks, should just understand that through its own reserves of philosophy, of religion, of political liberty. It should just get that. And yet he says that it doesn't. Why doesn't it? And he says, actually, the East, the Soviet East, the communist East, and the free West, he says, are gripped by sort of the same malady. And that malady is materialist humanism, to use his term. And that materialist humanism exalts man to the nth degree and sort of removes man, removes the West from the primary ideas that shamed it, that shaped it and formed it, that being the experience of Athens and of Jerusalem. And when you take that into account, you start to see how the West, in this quest that it had been on, he says, for, you know, he says from the Renaissance and from the Enlightenment, couldn't actually grapple with the total evil that the Soviet Union represented. And then he starts to point in ways that make people very uncomfortable in these speeches towards problems in the West, towards the inability of the West to defend its own institutions, towards its leaders struggling to defend the virtues that had shaped and formed their countries. He talks about the inability to punish terrorists attacking Western nations. That happened in Europe in the 70s and 80s. He talks about the inability of the West to defend its public culture, to have sort of an understanding of the importance of work and of family and of the goods that man should be properly attuned to. We were kind of being led astray. And so for all of these reasons, you know, and this, the grand statement of this is in the Harvard address in 1978, where he really formulates this into a full statement and does so at sort of what is, you know, seen as the pinnacle of American higher education, is largely excoriates the West. But he does so, I point out, he does so as a friend. And friends tell the truth because they need you. And Solzhenitsyn needed the West to vindicate its own spirit and its own true self in order to overcome communism. And he was fearful, not that we didn't have enough tools or prosperity or ability to do that, but that decline first begins in the human heart and the human spirit, and that was his fear.
He was keen on Dostoevsky's demons. Why?
So demons, Fyodor Dostoevsky, the great Russian 19th century novelist, was also an astute observer of ideology. And Russia in the last half of the 19th century was gripped by socialist, utopian, nihilist ideologies, particularly in its upper and educated classes. Dostoevsky's novel, The Demons, sometimes titled The Possessed, is really the grandest literary study we can read of how ideology destroys a human person. And in that novel, we're kind of in a provincial town in Russia. And what we might think of as kind of intellectual characters use their powers to sort of destroy this town, turn people against one another, even convince someone to murder another person who's believed to be no longer trustworthy in their sort of socialist revolutionary cell. And there's this inability. We see people unable to repudiate this, to strike it down, even though they have the opportunity to. And Solzhenitsyn sees this as sort of writ large application to situations in the West in the 1970s. And cites it. He cites it one time in giving a speech in Zurich, I want to say in 1974. And in other places, he refers back to Dostoevsky. And so it's also one of the best Dostoevsky scholars currently writing now at Northwestern, Gary Saul Morson, has done much the same kind of work in publications like The Wall Street Journal, The New Criterion, talking about Dostoevsky's The Demons applying to America in the summer of 2020 and going forward in various ways in which we are encouraged to repudiate our own heritage and history as Americans. So this is all very immediate and current, even though we're drifting with these ideas that have been extant in the West now, for over 150 years. They come forward in various new, applications.
It's surprising to me in my seniority, Richard, how I did not understand this in the 20th century. And it's now very clear cut to me about the spiritual shallowness of the West. Does that surprise you? We just have a few seconds. Does that surprise you that you now get it and you didn't then?
No, I mean, I largely acclimated to Solzhenitsyn, to writers like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, even perhaps, as a young man, because I was kind of sensing as a young person there was something dramatically wrong with my country.
Right.
Ever since I have grown as an adult, these problems have continued to grow more acute. And so it seems to me this is as much an internal battle of human conscience as it is a lot of other things happening.
Richard Reinsch, Editor-in-Chief of Civitas Outlook.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.